here are, for example, Hubbard type models, where there's a fermionic degree of freedom per lattice site, or spin models, spin chains for that matter, and I think we will hear a lot about all these usual suspects many times later this week in this session. So that's the type of system we have in mind, lattice systems with exactly one physical degree of freedom per site, as is also depicted here. Admittedly, I've shown this picture before, but I just like it too much. It's shown at my around the corner of my former London office, where in the summer there's really exactly one bird per pole, and only the exact mod insulator. It's no disorder at all.
It's spinning in different directions.
Okay, that's an internal limit. Classic. Anyway, so in this talk we will have a look at grasping such systems in terms of tensor networks. That's the point of this talk. And usually I like to give talks where there's one, well, by my standards, like relatively big statement or theorem in the center or something. Here I think it makes sense to look at 2.5 small and quite simple statements, which are nevertheless fun and maybe interesting, that relate to grasping many-body systems in terms of tensor networks, after a few introductory words complementing what Ignacio has already nicely said. So the first part will be a cleaning up task. So we've heard of the tensor networks that Ignacio has mentioned, and there's the two workers, the two big guys, the most prominent tensor networks describe correlated systems in more than one dimension. That's the MERA on the one hand, kind of a scale invariant approach related to real space minimization on the one hand, and the PEPS approach that was featured so prominently in Ignacio's talk on the other hand. And it makes sense to think how these quite different in spirit ideas of MERA on the one hand and PEPS on the other hand are actually quite related. And you will see that there is a relationship, and put them, well, it seems fair to say, in a kind of unifying framework. So that's our first cleaning up task, or first. The second theme is related, again, to tensor networks. But usually these tensor networks are used in variational methods to numerically describe strongly correlated quantum many-body systems in an approximate fashion. But there we will ask whether one can find situations where one can exactly kind of write out ground states in terms of tensor networks, and this is what we do when we look at exactly solving frustration-free in 1/2 models. So that would be a kind of fun, small, toy set of quantum systems where one can say everything exactly and easily and efficiently. And what is more, it kind of introduces the concept of a tensor network with an input, which is a fun concept in its own right. And this is all related a lot to what Ignacio said a second ago. And then I had planned to have an outlook, but I'm not sure how this will be going, also in time, and I try to be strict in time. I might be saying something on a bit on fermionic tensor networks, not on quantum fields, because Frank sent an email, he will talk about quantum fields later. that's something that Tobias, my chair in the office with, and myself, together with Frank, following up Frank's and Ignacio's work on that, do quite a lot, but I'm not mentioning this at all, for the reason that Frank has a priority claim, and we'll speak about this later. So this will be kind of a short overview.
No, yes, if you ask me whether I would talk about continuous quantum methods concept, I'd say yes.
Exactly.
There's a causal...
Frank didn't send out a flurry of emails to everyone.
Oh, no, no. Oh, that wasn't wrong impression. So it's not... It might have been on the New York Times front page, but it was not. But I asked Frank. Good point. I might, depending on time, say a few words on what is written there, but let's see how it goes. Okay, a few introductory remarks. I think everybody in the room is aware of this, but to kind of set this tone, it's an early talk, that it cannot have much. So think of having a ground state of a local Hamiltonian, so nearest neighbor, finite range interaction, a ground state sitting there, and we all know that correlation functions, if you measure here and measure there, will decay with the distance in cell axis. So correlation functions decay. For gap models or non-critical models, that's even true exponentially with the distance, as is a consequence of the Lie-Bronson theorem. No, but as we know, there's also a sharper, stronger notion of locality of correlations in ground states of many body systems, and that's related to the concept of entanglement entropy that will feature a lot in later talks. This week there is an entire day dedicated to this. And the idea is that you have a many-body system, you look at a sub-part of it, some region, and look at the reduced state of that region and ask how the entropy of that reduced state alone, BAM is not so interesting, but how that value scales with the size of the region if you make it larger and larger. And well, one could ask, how does that scale with the size of the region? But the naive answer might be, well, the entanglement is an extensive quantity, of course, that should be kind of a volume dependence where one just counts the number of degrees of freedom of the interior of the matter. But, as we should know, this is not quite the case usually, but there's much less entanglement in such systems. Usually, if you have a ground state of a model, then the entanglement entropy will grow, but eventually just scale like the boundary area of the system. So that's true for any ground state of either free bosonic models and arbitrary lattices. It's true for arbitrary gap strongly correlated one models in 1D, or also time evolved systems from product as follows from a stronger version from Lee Robinson here. And if I might say so, we this year put out a review article. It's my advertisement on area loss for the entanglement entropy, where we try to put together the state of affairs at the moment. And as Ignacio has very nicely said, tensor network states, so FES or PEPs, free tensor networks, LIRA, IPEPs, DNTS, there's a number of classes in the zoo. They take the idea seriously that kind of Hilbert space is fiction and that you only have to parameterize the relevant classes. So that usually parameterizes such low entropy states, or more precisely, they approximate well states that satisfy an area log in the first place. And it's called tensor network states because the coefficients of which in some product basis would be achievable by constructing a suitable tensor network, as Ignacio has already explained. So this is the kind of the credo paradigm here. Since nature explores a small subspace anyway, one can often efficiently parameterize that subspace using tensor networks, as this is the subspace one is interested anyway in. So this was my introduction. So let's come to our first theme on cleaning up task on relating MIRA and PEPs. So MIRA stands, Ignacio has briefly mentioned that, stands for multi-scale entanglement randomization. It's a very nice idea. It goes back to P3, and I think he will also mention that later in this talk. It's a tensor network that is a sequence of isometries and disentanglers. That is also related to re-space normalization. So the most naive re-space normalization would be one as depicted here, where you have, say, two spins, you map them to one with an isometry. If two spins, you map them to one with an isometry, to one, and you have a top. But MIRA is a bit, has an additional step, namely a layer of disentanglers, which you put in between, giving rise to a tensor network in 1D of that structure. And you see what this does. I mean, these guys are physically nearest neighbors, but they only talk to the top layer in the tensor network, which is not such a good idea. The point of the disentanglers is to turn things into the right physical subspace before we make a renormalization step one layer up in the pre-tensor network. So this is a nice idea. It's an instance, or could be viewed as the instance of real space renormalization. It's related to contractor randomization, which is not the same thing, but certainly related in spirit to MIRA. And it's a scale invariant approach that grasps, in particular, 1D critical models very well. But the same idea makes perfect sense in 2D and 3D, and which is the most interesting case if one would like to really simulate correlated many body models, because in 1D, D-imaging pretty much does the job in any other way. So that's kind of a nice scale invariant approach, grasping kind of critical-like models with a renormalization interpretation behind. And we will hear more about this from the creator. MIRA has nice features. For example, it features a causal code, which means that local expectation values can be efficiently computed. Meaning if you have an observable just sitting here in the lattice, then you can compute its expectation value efficiently, because one has to acknowledge that you can just cast, these are all isometries or unitaries, so look at the state and the conjugate, you can just cancel all the unitaries that are not in this kind of upward causal cone. And indeed, there is this causal cone that has a finite width, which consists of all the gates that cannot be cancelled out, that will have a finite width. And in order to contract the network, you just have to work yourself upwards to the top layer. And this is always an efficient task, obviously efficient in the system. So this is Mira on the one hand, me. Tree-like, so to say. Now, an idea that's quite different in spirit and very powerful, as was in the center of Ignacio's talk, are PEPs. So PEPs stands for projected entangled pair states. That's by now the most common name. There are also other names on the market for the same thing. What some people call them tensor product states, high-dimensional matrix product states, generalized valence bond states, and a couple of others. They essentially all mean the same thing. And Ignacio has already nicely introduced this kind of tensor picture. That would be the tensor picture of a one-dimensional set, so matrix product state, where these are the tensors. This is the bond dimension, this is the physical index, and you just contract this one thing if you want to and compute expectation values. That's one-dimensional PEPs. So this is the tensor network of two-dimensional systems, just a planar tensor network. We've seen exactly the same picture in Yasser's talk. So it's a planar tensor network with many natural properties. Essentially all natural properties that we know from MPS are inherited to two dimensions. One can exploit symmetry and so on. It's a very nice tensor network with all the desired features, maybe only that it's not exactly efficiently contractible. That's actually a sharp p-complete problem. But for practical purposes, one can do approximate construction schemes that work very well in practice. I think this is fair to say. The first idea was invented by Funding and Ignacio to do it. So on the one hand, Mira. On the other hand, PEPs. So these are possibly the most prominent two classes of tensor networks to simulate strongly correlated models. They feature also in simulation of fermionic models and so on. And it might make a lot of sense to see how these two different schools, the Mira head school and the PEPs head school, are actually related. And in this theme, what am I doing with time? Oh, I'm talking quickly, no? No?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good. This is just a matter of coding efficiency. So how are they related? We will see that, in fact, they are related. There's a deep connection in that one can be grasped in terms of the other. So surprisingly, Mira is PEPs, or Mira is an efficiently contractible subset of PEPs, or more precisely said, for any Mira or any tensor network states that could one view as a kind of generalized instance of a Mira, so sharing all the features that the Mira has, one can find a PEPs with a bond dimension that does not depend on the system size at all, and which is an efficient polynomial in the chi of the Mira in the first place. Whatever any such Mira, one can encode the state in the PEPs. It's just like, I mean, what's, you have a kind of isometry, how many degrees, what's the Hilbert space dimension that you keep upwards? And we'll come to that in a second. We make more fine print to this. So you can grasp a Mira, like a tree-like construction, in terms of a planar tensor network of a PEPs, and this encoding is efficient. So how can this be? So kind of PEPs gives rise to a unified description in that respect. So how can that be? And so the exact construction is a bit nitty-gritty. It's also not very difficult, I must say. But I mean, the details are nitty-gritty, but I will just highlight on couple of slides, three slides, something, the important ideas, and then I will just bullet point off the rest. But it's the basic idea is actually pretty simple. The first thing is, the first insight is not very deep at all. It is that any tensor network state
can be encoded in a TENS. Well, in one way or the other, it's surely possible. Think of a tensor network. You just take all the tensors in the tensor network, and you put them and place them somewhere in the physical lattice. So even if you have a unitary gate acting to your neighbor, you don't have the unitary gate, but you put the unitary gate somewhere, conceive it as a tensor, and have an edge to your neighbor that links to this one tensor. So every tensor is distributed somewhere on the lattice. And then you have an undirected graph that gives the contraction lines of the tensor network. That's just some graph, which you now have to embed in terms of a path that you fix in your physical lattice. This you can do. So this depicts a rather strange-looking tensor network of that fashion. So you have these are the boxes of the physical indices. I have placed the tensors, which are these gray boxes or these, what's this color called? I don't know. I wouldn't even know in my native language. So put somewhere, and you have chosen a certain contraction line. And so this is some block that you put out, and that's this little piece highlighted here. Of course, you can merge these tensors and make a kind of super tensor out of them, just probably putting them together. Then you have another object that's another tensor with more contraction lines coming. Well, that's not surprising. And what is more, well, you can, of course, just see this as a new index in increasing the vector space dimension of each of these tensors. And, well, you've made a tensor of the desired form out of that. That is obviously possible for any of the sites. So in principle, if you have any tensor network, you can always arrange it in one way or the other in such a planar form. The problem being, of course, that this is not necessarily an efficient prescription. There could be a piling up of tensors. You could be forced to put many tensors on top of each other, or you could have many edges coming out, and say if the number of edges scales linearly, maybe with the system size, that might be innocent looking, but obviously this is related to an exponential computational cost when you want to contract the tensor network at the end of the day. So the difficult bit is to show that this can be done in an efficient way where you don't overshoot in this fashion. Now there's a bit of a fine print. That's my fine print slide. So what is a mirror? There are many versions of a mirror, and one should all conceive them as mirrors. I think you three would agree that there's many different variants that share certain features. So this list would be, I think, all the features that these mirror type states share that we could come up with, well, that was within our imagination that any of these states would have. So that's not a restrictive list, but it just pushes it as far as we can to think of what a mirror could possibly be. With the exception that we think of cubic lattices, but just for simplicity of notation for the purpose of this talk, obviously, we only have upper bounds, so we can always embed any other lattice into a cubic lattice in the first place. So any such mirror would have temporal layers. T, temporal layers, labeled by tau, going from zero, that's the physical layer, up to the top temporal layer. So you have a branching ratio B, which could be whatever, and you would have L to the power of D sites, where L is B to the power of T, where B is the branching ratio. So you have the physical lattice at the bottom, you have the top layer at the top, and to each layer you associate a coarse-grained lattice, L tau, that has this suitable number of cells of the physical lattice in it, with the whole thing at the bottom and the top layer at the top. This is a feature any such state would have. You would want an upper bound to the vector space dimension of each of the tensor indices that should not grow unboundedly. Well, needless to say, should be an upper bound to the order of the tensor, that not everybody is coupled to everybody. That would not be, certainly not be a mirror anymore. And there should be an assignment of tensors of layer tau to cells such that the number of tensors is bounded above, from above by some number, and the distance of contracted tensors in L1 norm should be bounded by some constant. B is the branching ratio, so that's the kind of, if you map two spins to one, that would be two, for example. It's just the kind of the scaling dimension that you have. And you can have contraction lines between different temporal layers, whatever, as you want, but there should be a bound to the width of temporal layers. You don't want contraction lines from the top layer to the bottom always. So that could be a thickness of 10 guys, right, that you might allow for. That would be a reasonable thing. In other words, there's a coarse and cone. Right, so that's just a description of a mirror-like construction where you have a causal cone that has the feature that we saw earlier that you can efficiently contract things. Okay, so how do you do it? I have only two slides. Very simple idea is, well, it's all about good bookkeeping, how to do this. So you take your physical lattice and you look at the tensors in the tensor network with all the temporal layers, and you take all mirror tensors of a cell in a coarse-grained lattice of a certain temporal layer, and put it down to a single individual latticide of the physical system according to this formula up there. So that's the coordinate of the of all the tensors in cell N of layer tau that you assign the site in the physical lattice over there. So that's v to the power of tau n plus v to the power of tau minus 1. So all these coordinates are B-adic valuations giving tau minus 1. So that's a prescription. It's a kind of a bag. You take the bag, you put it to the physical lattice somewhere. That's already the first insight. And there's a second insight, and then I'm done with it. The tricky bit is, of course, how to put edges. You have edges in the graph. You have to make paths in the lattice to get it done. And here the idea is, well, you have all these different non-overlapping sublattices in the physical lattice coming from different temporal layers. The point is that it's chosen such that you have all these different subsets of grids. You have edge sets that connect all these different points in the physical lattice. And then you just pick the shortest L1 line in the respective lattices whenever there's a contraction line in the physical lattice. So that's a well-defined prescription of putting edges, paths into the physical lattice, and you have a way of putting tensors onto physical lattices. And doing that, one can show that this, if you go through this procedure, you have PEPs, tensors with tensor indices coming out, that this gives rise to a PEPs with a bond dimension which is bounded from above by this expression here, which is an order one constant. So you can bound this from above by an expression that's independent of the system size. In other words, any mirror in more than one dimension can be encoded in a PEPS with a bond dimension that is independent of the system size and which is inefficient in the bond dimension of the mirror. So the kind of the PEPS picture gives a kind of framework for grasping that. You have a mirror, you can always encode this in the PEPS. So that's the crudest possible construction. That doesn't give very strong scaling factors. One can also think of refined constructions, which are more difficult, where you have local encodings and where you balance suitably the trade-off between the local encoding of your tensors and the competition of having other tensors coming from other temporal layers nearby. But one can make a refined encoding that gives rise to a much better encoding of the mirror in the first place. So how's the scaling? So Ignacio said that there's polynomials and polynomials. So what is the degree of the polynomial that comes out? Well, so for the standard 2D mirror where you have 4x4 plaquettes as isometries, and then you have a 4x4 to 1 isometry to the next layer, and then you iterate that scheme, that would, for this simple construction that I just told you, would give pi to the power of 6 as the scaling, whereas the refined scaling would just give the square of the mirror dimension would be the chi of the PEPs. So that's not a crazy polynomial. So a reasonable polynomial if you map the mirror into the PEPs. So that's just the square of the chi that comes out if you make this coding. There's another related interesting idea that you can look at with these methods is that you could ask, okay, to what extent is having an area law and having an efficiently contractible tensor network one-to-one? So are there tensor networks that you can efficiently contract but nevertheless logarithmically violate an area law, reminding of the area law violation of free fermionic fermions? So dealing at the boundary between efficiently describable sets and entanglement scaling. And indeed, these things exist. They can be constructed using quantum cellular automata, using very similar ideas. So to come up with a lesson of this first theme, so we have looked to put kind of MeRA and PEPS into a single framework, so to kind of come up with a unifying picture to see how MeRA can be related to PEPS and how MeRA can actually be encoded in the PEPS, and how, say, the entanglement structure of states that are being generated by an instant real-space normalization can be captured in the framework of a PEPS, and well, this is how this can be done. But note that this doesn't take away any charm of the MeRA as an ansatz class because, well, it's still very physical and very meaningful, and, of course, one shouldn't forget that MeRA are an efficiently, exactly contractible class of states, but one could view them as an efficiently contractible subclass of PEPS, which is a good thing to know. Yes, indeed. Indeed. I mean, also, I mean, it's an efficient class of PEPs, but if I give you the PEPs that comes out and I should ask you how to contract it, you wouldn't know. I mean, you would know you would go back to the MeRA picture and would then be able to look at the causal cone, but of course that feature is not shared by the PEPs that comes out anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you've shown is that you can rewrite it as a PEPs.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Efficiently in one dimension.
Exactly.
There are other things that would be quite important from a practical perspective.
Yeah.
One of them is, for instance, you can use a meter to describe a translation invariant system.
Mm-hmm.
And you just need to use a number of tensors, number mm-hmm. of parameters, which is only polynomial in the system size.
Indeed.
If you make this mapping,
yeah.
you will end up with yes. order n tensors.
Indeed.
So yeah. going from log n to n is something that yeah. you cannot
yeah. ignore. I couldn't agree more. So that's one more thing that... I mean, these are nice features that the translation approach would have that would be totally screwed up by flat mapping. I mean, maybe you could even make a translation variant version error, but that would be a priori in the way we did it, would be screwed up. Certainly by the refined PEPs, that's a fairly complicated construction that would not keep the symmetry of the problem.
And the other observation would be that I think you have to make if yep. this. If you put it in a perspective of
yep.
let's use these methods for something useful,
yep.
is that PEPs that you obtain
mm-hmm.
has correlations all over the place. The organization of correlations are, you put correlations that correspond to different length scales, you put them back into a plane.
Yeah, but
so optimizing that could be terrible.
No, I agree. But on the other hand, what is nice is that, I mean, also, I mean, I have a second theme, it's 30 minutes. Can I push part of this? I mean, I'm super interested in this discussion. Can I put part of this discussion at the end? Will you do it with the chairman? But I have to ask you a question. No. First, I ask you a question. Indeed, but the nice thing also is that, I mean, you have like real space. I mean, you were the one to realize how real space urbanization should be captured like that, and that has a certain entanglement structure of the states. And that, well, that could be captured in the text of a certain small bond dimension, which is not too high with all the properties that you could derive from knowing that this is a PEPS. But, yes.
I have a question about how entanglement scales. Naive-like that when you have a tree-like structure to describe state,
yes.
the entanglement may have a more entanglement.
Yeah, this is true in 1D, but in 2D, it's, well, that's, there's many ways to show it. I think it's Giffrey had a proof somewhere. No, it actually has area laws. And exactly. There's a free structure, and that's less.
So
but I mean, this also is a consequence of this statement. If perhaps they must have a finite bond dimension, there must be an area law. Indeed, they have an area.
So the tree don't encode more entanglement.
Yeah, in a way, they should not. They should, but they don't.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Imagine that I put in a two-dimensional
yeah.
mirrors vertically that don't talk to each other. This is not a mirror then, because I put in a two-dimensional structure,
yeah.
just MeRA,
MeRA,
like one-dimensional systems. This would have a violation of this cannot be written as a PEPS.
Yes.
So this means that this is not a MeRA?
No, this...
Why is it not?
Huh?
Why is it not?
Why is it not?
It has a finite causal cone, everything is fine.
So you would have like one-dimensional systems?
Exactly, I just consider two-dimensional system as a one-dimensional system, and I put one-dimensional MeRA.
Yes.
So the area law would be the size, the number, times logarithm. So it would violate the area law, right?
Yeah, okay, true, but then, okay, agree. Say, okay,
No, but then there must be something wrong.
Yeah,
no, but so this is not part, I mean, okay.
You're not force screening on both directions of the lattice.
Exactly. It means that would not be considered two-dimensional.
Yeah,
so in the Fayard version of a two-dimensional mirror would have a kind of coarse graining in both directions.
No, but yes, you could consider a weak version. You could now entangle.
No, indeed, I agree. I mean, that would be an interesting topic. All right. So what I said before, this kind of general fix, that's like a meaningful, say, two-dimensional version of the mirror in coarse grain both directions, where you already have like coarse grain things you have coarse grain in both directions, which is fixed. And the rest is very loose, how you have bonds and so on.
But this back to your assumptions?
Oh, yeah.
So which one is violated?
Oh, it's the second one. I mean, the coarse graining. That would be violated, that you have here this switch layer, so the coarse grain lattice that has a certain number of cells that you have in the lattice, that would be violated. Because that would not be fair.
Why isn't that violated?
It is violated because it's not, I mean, you fix that the number of, you fix the coarse grain lattices that you have. That would be a different coarse grain lattice. Yeah.
Well, okay, let's move on.
Okay, that's a very interesting discussion, but I'll be quick here anyway. Okay. 33 minutes, okay, good. But that's 35 including questions, right? We already had some questions. Anyway, so let's move on to sort of a different topic.
You have 10 minutes left, right?
10 minutes.
Yeah?
45 minutes left.
Yeah.
Yeah, 10 minutes.
10 minutes, that's good. So we still think of graphing many better systems in tensor tensor networks. Now, in a slightly different theme when we look at frustration-free spin 1/2 models. And, well, it's also because we have met the spin-off describing quantum many body systems in terms of tensor networks that one might be tempted to think that eventually, at some point, any of us local Hamiltonian models can be efficiently described by such methods, but this is not the case because there have been recent results that give cause for concern in this respect, simply because this is to find balances of local Hamiltonian systems is a computationally difficult problem, and even to approximate the ground state energy of a local Hamiltonian problem is in general QMA complete, so that's in a way more difficult than NP, and so presumably even a quantum computer could approximate the ground state energy of such models. And these models have been before two-dimensional models, but now they're, I mean, you're not talking about this, I guess, but
right. Maybe the RIT might be talking about this later this week on like one-dimensional instances of such families of models. So here we will approach the question of the difficulty of describing a finding ground system of many-body models from the other side, namely where we look at the class of models where everything is easy. It's a fun toy class of models where you can just write out everything. In particular, you can just write out the entire ground state manifold efficiently and exactly, and in particular, you can compute expectation values of local observables in an exact and efficient fashion. And you can also compute area loss, and it relates to something that could be viewed as kind of tensor network with an input, and it's also the converse approach, I think, to what Ignacio looked at on apparent Hamiltonians of tree tensor networks. It's kind of the converse. So here, natural means, and the model is the frustration-free nearest neighbor spin 1/2 systems on arbitrary lattices. So given an arbitrary lattice, whatever, you have a nearest neighbor spin-spin interaction, and if it's frustration-free, you can write out the ground state manifold exactly, which we found surprising. Where natural means, yes?
You need an arbitrary graph.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
And then you can actually.
Yes, indeed.
Two-body interactions, right?
Two-body interactions. And when natural means, that's the disclaimer, natural means that the excited state of the Hamiltonian concerns an entangled state, which one could view as the part of the semantics of an interaction term. But as a matter of taste, I say natural means there's an entangled state. To remind ourselves what frustration-free means, because that's different versions of this term. So we have a Hamiltonian with a nearest neighbor term, and that's called unfrustrated or frustration-free if not only the ground state energy is zero. That can always be achieved by just shifting the energy, but where each of the state vectors of the ground state manifold that can be degenerate, doesn't have to be unique, but each of these guys are already eigenvector of eigenvalue zero of each of the individual terms, hence it is unfrustrated or not frustrated. That answers your question. Right? So how do we solve these models? I'm very quick because I don't have much time. So the idea is start from ingredients from actually Bravais' algorithm for quantum TUSAT. That's the closest quantum analog to TUSAT, which asks for an assignment of Boolean variables in a way such that a list of constraints on pairs of variables are satisfied. To generalize this to capture the entire ground state manifold of frustration-free Hamiltonians. So I think if you have a Hamiltonian term, HUV, of rank, they can have rank.
You're going to describe any state
in the ground state manifold? No, you get the entire ground state manifold. But I will try to be quick. I might have to say something in the discussion, or we discuss that later. But I try to go quickly over it, and then we discuss the state. This can have rank 1, 2, 3. If it has rank 2 and 3, then this local term fixes a subspace of a dimension at most 2, of which the reduced state of the ground state has to be a mixture thereof. So acknowledging that, you can make an asymmetric reduction 2 to 1 of these two spins into 1 as an encoded, redundantly encoded qubit, and make a congruence of the Hamiltonian, and just asymmetrically reduce this spin out of your system, and you can efficiently keep track of the kernel of the original Hamiltonian. So this will eliminate this coupling term. It will do something to neighboring coupling terms, but this can be an induced single-qubit Hamiltonian terms, but that can be dealt with. Even you have to combine terms, but there's an efficient prescription of doing that. So you can keep track of the kernel. If you have such a guy, with these guys being rank 2 or rank 3 terms, you would eliminate this, and so on. Loops, meaning you have a single-side Hamiltonian generated. Okay, and if you have single-side terms, then you can asymmetrically reduce these spins from your Hamiltonian by just projecting deep down where this is an element, a state vector of your of the kernel of this single-qubit term. Okay, there's some work to be done. One has to show that for our purposes, the contraction order does not matter, that one can keep track of the kernel of the Hamiltonians in a suitable fashion. It doesn't matter how one does this procedure temporally. One has to prove that the property of being natural is conserved in the course of this. That's not very difficult, but it's a bit more technical to show this, but this can be done. And one has to find a certain normal form of Hamiltonians of rank 1, which is not only each of the guys are rank 1 at the end of the day, but they're also enclosed under certain induction of new Hamiltonian terms, because if you have beta AB and beta BC at two terms, then that would also be in the kernel of a new beta prime term, which gives rise to new two rank terms, which you can again eliminate with the same procedure. So there's a certain normal form of rank 1 natural Hamiltonians at the end of the day. For this, one now can find that the ground state manifold is known, namely it's just a symmetric subspace over these spins under known local invertible transformations. You just locally deform your spins from a symmetric subspace. That's the entire ground state manifold of this. And to finish this point, now if you want to compute expectation values of local observables, you can just turn things around. The whole procedure that we looked at is read from bottom to the top is a tree tensor network. You have these local deformations which you can put from the top to the tree tensor network. That's just a tree. And on the top layer, you don't have a spin like in a mirror, as we will also see later, but you have the entire symmetric subspace on the top. So that might be annoying, but that can be dealt with by acknowledging that you can just simply take n plus 1 linear independent product vectors and then symbolically Gram-Schmidtify them to get an orthonormal basis, which you don't have to do it in Hilbert space, but you can do it symbolically and in symbolically efficiently, and then you can efficiently contract this tensor network. So that's a fun thing. You have a tree tensor network. We're on the top layer. You don't have a spin, but you have an entire subspace on the top layer of this network, and expectation values of local observables can be efficiently exactly computed. They all satisfy area laws. Now for mixed state entanglement, because the ground state manifold is usually degenerate, but all of these models satisfy area laws, which gives rise to a novel class of states for which the area law is exactly known, which is true for any of these frustration-free models. And that's my last point that I make in order not to overrun with time. That gives rise also to a nice kind of Ansatz class. This idea of having a tree tensor network with an input on top can be used to simulate, of course, frustration-free models, but also almost frustration-free models, where you take the ground state manifold, of which you can completely sample efficiently, but look at small perturbations of having an unfrustrated time term plus lambda and a little bit frustrated term, and look how you can approximate models in this type. And this is a very simple ansatz, but significantly outperforms like mean field, and we're just combining this like with variation approaches like MIRA, where you have kind of a tree tensor structure with a symmetric subspace on top. So that's also a prominent, promising idea of actually it's a tensor network with an input in the first place. So the lesson of this second part, we look at a case where tensor networks were not used as variation approaches and numerical methods to approximate many-body states and variational approaches, but where, for this frustration-free model, you just write out the entire ground state manifold. You can efficiently sample from that manifold and efficiently compute things exactly. So that's a way of solving frustration-free models in an exact fashion, and it can be viewed as an instance of Riesz-based parameterization, which is exact, and introduces this idea of tensor networks with an input, which is a fun idea in its own right. And I think this I will skip. I had a few slides on fermionic tensor networks, but for the reasons of time, I will not go into detail, but rather conclude that we looked in this talk at grasping quantum many-body systems in terms of tensor networks in two flavors, where the third flavor would have been that fermionic tensor networks are just as efficiently contractible as spin ones, where in the first part we looked at relating MIRA and PEPS and found that MIRA and PEPS are actually quite related, and one can always think of a MIRA or encode a MIRA in terms of a PEPS, which also means that the kind of entanglement structure of Riesz-based normalization can be grasped in a framework of PEPS in the first place. And in the second part, we looked at an instance where tensor networks were not used as a kind of numerical procedure of approximately describing many-body systems, but where one can use tensor networks to just write out the ground state manifold, and one can sample efficiently from the ground state manifold in that fashion, which is a kind of fun toy class of models for which one knows everything. So they're in the easy class, so the other end of this QMA compete problems here, and that's the easy class down there, where one has a toy model, class of models to play with. And this glimpse of simulating fermionic systems is something for the coffee break, so thanks a lot for your attention.